Good morning and welcome to After Deadline. My name's Kathleen Strecker. I'm the editor of Coast Weekend at the Daily Astorian. And I am fortunate to have in the studio today as my guest, Carol Abraham. If any of you have lived here for any amount of time and your kids have taken piano lessons, you probably know Carol. She's taught more students in this town than anybody else, I think, for decades. And I'm so glad to have her here. She's going to talk about what it means to have music in your life as a kid, as an adult, anybody. So welcome, Carol. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. And you just ruined my life.
No, no.
I can no longer claim to be 39 years old.
Sorry.
And just before we hit our main subject, everybody listening, be sure to catch Kathleen Strecker's byline in Coast Weekend. It's usually good. Last night's was especially wonderful. If I ever get a bad cold, Kathleen, mm-hmm. I want to come to your house for the Harry Potter cure.
Oh, goodness. I don't know if I could do that again. In case you missed it or you haven't had a chance to read it yet. Yeah, I had a Harry Potter marathon over last weekend, and it was very fun, but I think I'm done with that for a little while. So
okay.
Anyway, thank you for the mutual plug there. That was cool. But yeah, those of you listening who tune in regularly on Friday mornings at this time, you know that we have editors and reporters from the Daily Astorian on, and they're usually talking with the movers and the shakers, you know, the local government and the people who are making the big news. And when it's my turn to host these shows, I always like to get people in who are working with young people in the community, because
absolutely,
that is our future movers and shakers. And so Carol is going to talk today about what music does to promote just a sense of community and education and just well-being overall for kids. So I want to start out by letting people know about you and your background. And you know, you didn't have to admit the thing about not being 39, because this is radio. People could have just, you know, had the picture in their minds. In any case, what is your background? How long have you lived in this area?
I moved to Astoria, Labor Day, 1961.
Wow.
Do the math, folks. It has gone by very fast. I was studying for my music certification at the time I moved here. I had studied with, I could give you a list of names of people who influenced me. And through the Oregon Music Teachers Association, there was an apprenticeship program available at the time. I don't have a master's degree, but in my own mind, I have gone down the list and accomplished those goals. Oregon Music Teachers Association had a very active group here. And people like Leon Erickson and Jesse Opdyke and Mildred Larson and Betty Phillips were all mentors, friends, educators. And when I completed my certification, which consisted of submitting students for examination, they didn't make me take examinations. They tested my students.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about being scary. And I remember when I got that precious piece of paper in the mail, my folks and I went back to the little hometown where I grew up because I wanted to look up Mrs. J.R. Cowan and say, look, I wasn't your best, most talented student, but look where I've gone.
Awesome.
And to my great disappointment, she had passed away just 6 months before.
Oh, no.
I love to take master classes. I have been privileged to sit at the feet of some very, very important people in the field of music education. Again, I don't want to go into a long list of names.
Mm-hmm.
University of Oregon, Oregon State, University of Idaho, Willamette University, Lewis and Clark College, all presented summer programs for ongoing education for music teachers. So that's kind of a patchwork quilt of background.
Good deal. So you've studied with a lot of greats. Who are some of your favorite composers to play? Because you do play some in addition to teaching. We'll get into that.
Okay. Everyone knows Johann Sebastian Bach,
sure,
the great master. A little sidebar. he had sons who were gifted and who made a splash in their day. Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach actually was the Kapellmeister at the Emperor's court, a higher position than his father ever held in his life. And he was very determined to strike out on a new path from his dad. And for his time, he was more successful, made a lot more money, made a bigger reputation, and yet history has shunted him slightly to the side, and his father is the one that history has validated. I play Handel better than Bach because he's just a little bit less intellectual, although he writes in the same style and from the same period, and I love to play him on the organ. So the people at Grace Episcopal get Handel on occasion.
Oh, very good. So you are the organist at Grace Episcopal.
Yes.
Is there anywhere else that you play regularly?
I'm a teacher bred and born. I'm not a performer bred and born. It's I do it as part of the total package. Performance scares the living daylights out of me sometimes. But it is fun. I play for my students, of course.
Sure.
I did get to play on the new 9-foot grand at the Steinway.
Oh, nice.
At the Liberty Theater.
Right.
And that was a very exciting experience.
Oh, I'm sure.
And the audience may have intimidated me, but my joy was that the piano did not.
Isn't that great?
It is so fabulous.
So fun. Have you ever done any composing yourself?
I am not a composer. I'm an appreciator more than a composer. I always felt like these great people have such wonderful ideas. It just doesn't happen for me in that same way.
Well, we all need people to play what they've composed, right?
Absolutely.
So, there we go. So what led you to a teaching career then? What made you decide that that was the avenue you were going to take?
I started teaching in the third grade.
Wow.
When the teacher put me in a corner with a struggling reader.
Really?
And it's just the thing in life I derive absolutely the most joy from. When a kid's eyes light up because they've got it. I just don't know many feelings in life that are better than that.
Oh, I agree. How many students do you estimate you have taught over the years, piano students?
I would have to go into my dusty boxy files and count up. I have no idea. Probably several hundred.
I'm sure. And generational, because now I know you have students who are children of your
former students.
That's amazing.
My students range in age from 5 to 85. And that's fun, too.
Oh, yeah. Is 5 about the youngest you will take?
I think so. There are wonderful kinder programs for that people can, I've done some of the coursework, people can do specific things with small children in groups with other instruments, and it would be fun, but
right,
I'm too busy doing what I'm doing to detour into that area.
That's right. Now, where do you teach? Do you have a studio?
I have a studio somewhere? In my home.
In your home. So all your students come to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a 6-foot grand and a digital piano and an Allen organ and a keyboard for those who need to access that.
There you go.
We do duets,
yes.
Do piano things.
Excellent.
Lots of fun.
So now there are a lot of different curricula out there.
Yes.
Different programs of books, you know, different brands, I guess. Do you follow any one established program? Like, I don't know, just for example, the Alfred method.
Alfred is very, very solid. And again, from the old John Thompson days, pedagogy has completely advanced and taken advantage of new scientific discoveries and the brain research that's going on. And so the new things that come out are frequently integrating more and more and better and more efficient ways of instructing kids, today's kids versus the kids of the 40s or right, the 50s.
Nice. Now, when you mentioned John Thompson, and this brings up the very first piano book I ever remember playing out of was one that my father gave me and showed me how to read music out of it. Mm-hmm. And it was called Teaching Little Fingers to Play. I'm sure a lot of listeners out there can relate to this. And it was published by John Thompson. And you mentioned that that represented a big shift in learning piano. How does that relate?
Well, book one, John Thompson, was in the piano bench when my old piano arrived delightedly in my little farmhouse. Mm-hmm. And I taught myself out of that book and the book that followed it for 2 years because there were no teachers available at that particular time and place. He just modernized the whole concept of children learning how to play. The traditional European method was very stringent. Mm-hmm. Some people spent as long as 2 years learning scales before they were allowed to touch music.
Yeah.
And my first piano teacher, who was European trained, said, before we went on recital, we wrote our piece out in longhand.
Wow.
Every note that was required. Well, that's a very stringent program that limits education to a chosen few. And John Thompson modernized it, made it more popular. Pianos were a very, very important part of home entertainment in pre-television and pre-radio days, if anyone listening can even imagine that such a time existed. And he just made it more approachable and more logical step by step.
And the crazy thing is, the John Thompson series, the exact books we're talking about, are still in print.
Still
you
in
can
print.
Buy them new at the music store. I don't know if Teals here carries them, but
yes, they do.
Yeah,
yes,
so
they do.
Right
I had to replace one because I gave my old copy to a student who was moving away to Alaska, of all places, where she wouldn't have a teacher.
Oh.
And I said, I had fun with this book. You can teach yourself a lot.
There you go. Well, excellent. Well, there's a whole range of different techniques and books out there. So
I didn't specifically answer your question.
Yeah.
I study every new coursework, curriculum that comes out. Mm-hmm. I have them all in my house. Some students react better to certain approaches than to others. I'm always trying to match the student's learning style, interests, and goals to the curriculum. So I have one that I use first. I have one that I like to use for kids with a particularly intellectual, scientific curiosity aspect. I will use the old Lynn Freeman Olson series with a child that presents that kind of imagination. Alfred is good and solid for most kids. I never put siblings in the same curriculum because I don't want sibling rivalry and comparisons to enter into the equation. So I have two or three other courses that I will use. And of course, I supplement all over the map.
Sure.
Depending on what the kid shows me. Kid, student.
Yes.
Let's be more up front here. What the student shows me. The student's goals are extremely important to me in my teaching.
Yes, and I'll mention that my daughter has taken lessons from you for, what is it now, 5 years or
probably,
so?
Probably,
that sounds
about right.
And so, and I've noticed this in her lessons, when you get a new piece out, you'll say, now, do you want to read this yourself or listen to it? Or you give her several options for different ways of learning it. So go into that a little bit. How do you determine what a student's learning style is?
A few years ago, an educator that I worked with in the public schools introduced me to a series of parenting theories called Love and Logic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's based on student choice, student consequences, child, and letting them learn. Of course, the trick is presenting the right amount of limited choices.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not giving away secrets to students. I will give them three choices, never more.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of them will lead my response in a different direction.
Yeah.
But it gives them ownership of the process.
Mm-hmm.
This education is not being imposed on them. They are invested in themselves.
Right.
That's part of my teaching philosophy.
Oh, that's excellent. And so when you get a brand new student, a young person comes to you for the very first time, they've never read any music before, they've never played any piano, how do you start them off? What's the first thing
dear.
You
do? Do I have to betray this secret?
Oh, no. However much.
The first thing I say to younger children is, is your mother making you do this, or do you really want to learn to play the piano?
Right.
That gives them the idea that I'm on their side. And then most of them really do want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're very young, it says, okay, this is how we start. And I do start with the body at the piano.
Mm-hmm.
How you sit. A batter has a stance. A tennis player has a way to hold the racket. The way you play the piano is by building neural pathways, muscular reactions, using the visual, but it's all about the ear.
Mm-hmm.
So we work to build that this is the first thing you need to do. And they get excited when they build their first chord, when they get their first little piece of music, when they have the five-finger pattern, when they can go up or down, loud or soft, smooth or bouncy. Mm-hmm. All those skills have to be learned first.
Right.
And when they're young.
Mm-hmm.
Transfer students, that's a different matter. They're usually in their teens. They may have a different foundation than I would have given them. But then we plug holes and get them in a position to go where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Do they want to do Chopin? These are what they have to do. Do they want to do Bach? This is what you have to do.
Okay.
Do you want to do jazz? I'm not well trained in jazz. I will confess that.
Uh-huh.
But I can show you how chord progressions work.
Right.
I have a wonderful set of books by a very talented American composer in the education field who introduces them. And then they can go on to somebody who's really expert.
There you go.
In jazz.
Right. And now, if you're like me, I work with a lot of young people in some music-related areas, too. But I think that sometimes people who are outside looking in, they assume that we're out there to make professional musicians out of these kids. And what's your take on that? Is that your goal?
I've had a few go on to professional work, and I've observed other people's students over the years go on to professional work. It's like being in a garage band with a dream that you're going to be the next Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how likely is that?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when you study music, you are doing such wonderful things for your own brain development and sometimes for character development, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell people, I'm not interested in creating concert artists.
Mm-hmm.
The American public can only support and reward so many. And I don't want you to be starving.
Mm-hmm.
And when my high schoolers tell me I'm going to study music in college, I rejoice. And then I say, what's your minor going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Because along with your major, you need to have a minor that makes you employable, because sometimes the pathway to adequate remuneration is very steep, and sometimes it's just a matter of whom the lightning strikes.
Well, this is true. So getting back to teaching this stuff like the scales and the theory, anybody who's taken lessons, you'll kind of roll your eyes and go, oh, that's the drudgery. That's the hard work you have to put in. How much emphasis do you place on that?
How much emphasis does a math teacher play on the multiplication tables? It may be boring and you may hate it, but it's a basis. It's a foundation for anything else that you're going to do. You have to learn. You have to subtract. To add, subtract, multiply, you just have to learn those basics. And then you have to learn fractions and algebra and on and on and on it goes. So they're important as structural elements on which you're going to have a foundation to build your musical dreams.
Right. So what happens if you get a student who doesn't own an acoustic piano? They only have an electronic keyboard at home. Does that make a big difference?
It's a challenge. It is a challenge. And yet, when I was a child longing for a piano, and I was told it was out of reach, I would have made a deal for a keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't been invented yet. They're not toys.
Mm-hmm.
They are and can be real musical instruments. That's one reason why I have a keyboard in my studio and a digital piano. So students who practice mostly on that kind of instrument can strut their accomplishments for me on those instruments. And then we go to the grand.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talk about how different the touch will be, how much more they'll have to play with, and they get excited. And then I do a little propaganda act on my teenagers. I say, you're going to be driving someday, and every vehicle you drive is going to be a little bit different. But you're going to be able to handle that because you took piano lessons. And it's advertising, but it's really true.
Yeah.
They really will be more capable of the subtle adjustments and flexibility mm-hmm. that life is constantly throwing at us.
I got to tell you, Carol, in addition to being the queen of the piano teachers in this town, you are the queen of metaphor.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I love it.
It just happens.
Every time I go for a lesson and I sit there and listen, it's amazing to me how much you bring to relate to what is going on in the lesson.
Because, you know, none of what we know is in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
It's all connected. And this marvelous thing we call the brain, this mm-hmm. biocomputer, which is entirely different inside every skull, and which I think over my years of experience and study and my passionate interest in these things, the more connections you make, the better it is.
So true.
Another thing I'll tell my students is, ooh, you did that scale just right. That's one nail in the board. But if the wind comes along, that board might spin.
Mm.
Now let's put another nail in the board and do it the second time. Metaphor again, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know. And then pretty soon we have it solidly in place. And it's not onerous. It's not ugly. It's not boring because we've met a challenge. Technique really does matter.
Yes. It does. So after your students have learned their scales and they've been working on pieces that you supply at to mm-hmm. give them something to have fun with and mm-hmm. to learn expression with.
Dessert is the most important part of
right.
any meal, folks.
Then where do they get to show off their skills and what they've learned? Do you have recitals?
I have an annual spring recital. In the older days, I used to manage two a year. That's been a little bit harder because of some health issues in my family.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one spring recital. Many of my students start playing for their churches in their early teens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful, exciting thing for me to see. Some of them decide to go on and study in college. I'm always encouraging them, play for your friends. They'll be so jealous of what you can do.
True. And I have to admit, my dad admitted to me that he started taking piano lessons because he thought it would make him popular with the girls.
Ah,
so, you know, there
brilliant
you go.
Man. That's as good as a red Mustang, isn't it?
Yeah, well.
At this last recital, one of my younger boys played a jazz version of the ubiquitous Canon in D mm-hmm. by Pachelbel. Everybody
great.
Loves that because that chord progression is so hypnotic mm-hmm. and attractive and enticing. So one of my adult students who was struggling with 16th notes and mm-hmm. all their various ramifications said, oh, I love that piece. I've got to do that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And now when she finishes this project, 16th notes will no longer be an issue for her.
Right.
Now, I could have given her some exercises by Czerny or Hannon, mm-hmm. but she wouldn't be having near as much fun.
Right. Perfect. Have you ever taught a prodigy? And I'm making the little quote signs here with my fingers. What's considered a prodigy? And have you ever had somebody come through your studio?
I have had. Now,
They are rare. Mm-hmm. Prodigy has a really hard row to hoe because of competition, so much to learn. It takes so many things to be a prodigy. But the biggest item is an intense desire. The physical attributes have to be there. The ear has to be keen. The eye maybe doesn't have to be good at reading, but you certainly have an advantage. There are prodigies who play only by ear. And I use Stevie Wonder as an example for some of my kids. Work on your ear. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need his eyes.
Right.
On the other hand, the music he plays is not what the whole world of music is yours when you learn to read. Mm-hmm. But the music he plays is either what he has heard or what his particular talent is inventing from within himself. But that's what he does, and he does it very well, and he's well paid for it. Here's to you, Stevie Wonder.
There you go.
You can do it blind. Mm-hmm. So it takes this combination of factors. Some kids aren't hungry. Mm-hmm. Some kids have wonderful physical skills, automatic ear-finger connection. Some kids are good readers. Some kids get the musical shapes and ideas and the relationships. But it's a prodigy is rare. Mm-hmm. I would not have wanted to be Mozart's teacher.
No.
His daddy did a pretty good job.
Right.
Like your daddy, I'll bet.
Oh, I don't know about that. How much practice time does it actually take to be proficient? We're not talking prodigy level here, but just proficient so that you can go on after you're all done and graduated with piano lessons and be able to pick up something and learn it to your own satisfaction. What's the minimum daily practice time that you recommend?
Teenagers are busier all the time. We ask more of them in school. They have more outside activities available to them. And then, of course, there is texting.
Right. Well, it's finger strength right there. Right.
It would be optimum for a student to spend an hour a day for something that you were really interested in and really devoted to. I think football players spend more time than that, don't they, on the field?
I would guess.
Yeah. Okay. Band practice at the high school's 45-minute session every day, and you're supposed to practice a little bit in between.
An hour is
a nice sum. I'm happy if I can get some of my kids to commit to a half hour. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I are fans of Malcolm Gladwell and the wonderful little book Outliers, where he took a long-known concept, 10,000 hours to proficiency. Mm-hmm. That means 3 hours a day for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Now, how good do you want to be?
Right.
Okay. Do you want to be a 33rd percent musician, an hour a day for the 10 years you sit on my piano bench from second grade to graduation? Might do it. Not many of our kids have 3 hours a day, but that would be the optimum.
Right. So we're just about to wrap up our time here. I know there's
so
much more we'd like to get to, but I just want to ask you personally, if you were not a piano teacher, what would your dream job be? What would you be doing?
Honey, it's my dream job.
Oh.
I just can't even imagine spending my life any other way in this beautiful town with these wonderful people. I told you I came here 50 years ago in a month from now, and I sat in that shabby Liberty Theater thinking, oh, if only I could inherit $10 million. But look, the community came together. People knew how to get the funding. That beautiful place, the heart and soul of our community. And then I think of us surviving the hurricane. I think of you putting out a newspaper by candlelight, flashlight. I think of this amazing town. And I feel blessed to be here. And I have no other place or no other job that would be more of a dream fulfilled for me.
Well, I think the community feels likewise about you. So,
we are
so glad to have you here, too. Thank you very much for coming and talking this morning. If anybody would like to reach you about piano lessons, I think you're in the phone book, right? Carol Abraham. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time on After Deadline.